Hello everyone, it's Friday the 11th of December and welcome to episode 35 of the Kite Podcast 2020 with me, Will Evans.
And me, Ben Eagle. Now, a week and a half ago, DEFRA published their Path to Sustainable Farming Agricultural Transition Plan document, which I'm sure you'll all have read cover to cover. It sets out DEFRA's broad intentions for the period 2021 to 2024 as we move towards a very different agricultural policy framework. But today, we wanted to delve into the thinking behind the direction we're going in the first place, and who better to do this with than Janet Hughes, who is Programme Director for Future Farming and Countryside at DEFRA. We're also joined by Kite's Managing Partner, Ros Hughes, and as always, we're also joined by everybody's favourite dairy market analyst, Chris Welkland. Chris, let's go over to you for the Milk Market Report. Where are you this week?
Well, I'm bringing you my report from the highest point of the highest mountain in Ben country today, which is Essex. And what fantastic views there are. A few hundred feet above my head, I can see the waves crashing on the beach. And I'm here because we're talking about the British countryside, the great British countryside, with our guest. And because she's the first Janet we've had on the show, I've written her a song.
Oh, wow.
But I'm not going to sing it. You'll be delighted to hear.
Why not?
I thought we were going to have a repeat of Jingle Week.
No. I wouldn't put my listener through that. I'm just going to read it. It's safer. And will those feet in future times walk upon England's mountains even greener than they are today? And will the holy lamb of God be better looked after in our fields due to a new animal welfare pathway? Or will all sheep farmers be blessed instead on England's pleasant pasture scene? Bring me my lump sum exit scheme if I want to quit farming. Bring me my sustainable farming incentive if I want to carry on. Bring me my beer. Oh, CAP unfold, because you're going to need a lot of beer, farmers. And bring me my electric satellite guided chariot. Not of fire, because fire is a wicked pollutant and we don't like them. I will not cease from mental fight trying to understand the new regime, nor shall my sword sleep in my hand. No, I'm going to pass on making a joke about that, Becky. Nor shall my sword sleep in my hand till we have built Janet Hughes et al.'s Pathway to Sustainable Farming Transition Plan in England's green and pleasant land. The end.
Brilliant,
isn't it?
Excellent.
I think, Chris, some of those lyrics do sound remarkably familiar.
All my own work, Becky, all my own words, so you won't find me plagiarising anyone. Talking of my own work, here's my market report, and the big story this week is on cream. Although prices have held firm for this week at the low to mid 130s, it's tanking down after Christmas. I've heard prices quoted as low as £1 a kilo. Now, it isn't unusual for prices to drop after Christmas, but this year is going to be even more unusual than normal. And that, of course, is due to the UK's inability to successfully conclude, and I quote ex-International Secretary Liam Fox, the easiest deal to do in human history. And also quote Gove, we hold all the cards on the EU trade deal. And all of the uncertainty of this is tanking prices. They're okay. Such low prices are okay for a short time, but not for long. And at the moment, with prices that I'm hearing, we're about on track for the second lowest December cream price of the decade. But on a positive front, butter held firm in Europe again. And also in the UK, but with sterling heading in the same direction as a negotiating team reputation, i.e. down, revenue should be increasing. Butter, for instance, on Wednesday before Boris's deal or die meal with Ursula was worth £2.925 a tonne, yesterday £2.970. So that's an extra 50 quid we've got. So on the upside, everybody, we've got some of that £350 million a week on Boris's bus back already, and we haven't even left properly. Spot milk is stable at 29 to 30p, so pretty good there still. and powders have had a decent week in Europe. It's a sign of stability there, pretty good. Futures are on the up still, which is good, up in the EU, up in New Zealand. And 3,500 euros for butter is in sight for May. That's a key target, I think. It's not quite there at the moment, but aiming in that direction. But of course, nobody has the faintest idea whether UK prices will mirror EU prices, because no one has the faintest idea about anything anymore, apart from Janet. On cheese, that's been crazy, crazy for months, and it's set to be more so now. Tesco is saying no one will eat brie anymore and will switch to cheddar. Except, of course, we can't make any more cheddar and we won't be able to import it either. So what the outcome of that will be is anyone's guess. So that's it from me for another week. It's time to hear about the plans to improve England's green and pleasant land and its farmers. But I think Janet and her team has her hands very full, because while England's politicians are positively looby-loo, we do have a fabulously beautiful country and wonderful farmers, even in Essex, Ben. Can you really make them both better, Janet? Goodbye.
God, I feel like a proper member of the team now I've had a Chris Snide.
Janet, thank you for your patience and for coming on the show. We want to talk about the bigger picture when it comes to thinking behind the transition and the new policy today. But can you start by telling us about you and your team at DEFRA? When you've been talking about general direction of travel, what have been your objectives?
Well, I'm still just slightly reeling from having the song read out. Yeah. I'm very disappointed it was read out rather than sung, though. I feel like we've all missed a great opportunity there. So starting with me, I've joined DEFRA last January, but I was working on Brexit readiness and then on COVID. And I joined the Future Farming and Countryside programme in June as programme director. And so I'm responsible for the programme that is going to deliver the agriculture transition plan that we published last week, which basically is everything we're going to do to move away from common agricultural policy onto a new English set of schemes. And I don't have a background in farming. My background is in getting things done in government and making sure that the things we do work for users. And that's what I intend to do here. And so when we talk about the direction of travel in the team, what we talk about being here to do is to help farmers do the right thing for their farm and for the environment at the same time. And so everything we're trying to do should be in that general direction and be serving that mission. And what we talk about is trying to do the right things to achieve the outcomes that we're here to do. And the outcomes that we're here to achieve are about two things, both at the same time. One is prosperity and a competitive, vibrant agriculture sector. And the other is much better environmental, climate change and animal welfare outcomes. And we think over the long term, you can't have one of those without the other. You need to have a vibrant, competitive sector in order to be able to achieve those environmental outcomes. And if you want to continue having a vibrant, competitive sector, then you need to look after the environment and the resources that we rely on. So we're always trying to pursue those two objectives. And then in addition to doing the right things, we want to do those things in the right way, so that what we're doing is actually deliverable and works. And we know that in the past we've had goes at reform in this area that haven't worked, and so we want to learn the lessons from that and make sure we don't repeat them. And then that's why we're doing a kind of gradual rollout, a test and learn approach. And you'll hear me talking loads about co-design, which is where we want to work with farmers, and we are working with farmers to design the new future and make sure that it really works for people on the ground, so that we're not just dreaming something up in Whitehall, unleashing it on the world and wondering why it falls flat, but instead all the way through we're working with farmers. So that's kind of where we're coming from. And I'm sure we'll get into more detail about what exactly we're doing and why and how.
Yeah, okay. Now, of course, you recently published your latest agricultural transition document, which sets out the path from 2021 to 2024. From your point of view, what should be the main take-home messages of the document for dairy farmers?
So there's a lot in there. It's 60-something pages. And we tried to write it in as plain language as we possibly could and as little policy speak as we possibly could. And we have also published a booklet for farmers that's shorter. So I really encourage everyone to take a look at the actual documents and not just rely on the coverage. But I think the main message that I would want everybody to take home from this is that there is a positive way through this transition for everyone if you're prepared to plan and adapt. And I would really encourage everyone to do that from now if you haven't started already. Don't wait until the full environmental land management scheme is ready in 2024 to do that. There are things that will be available from 2021 onwards by way of productivity support and existing schemes and other things that you can do both on your farm, regardless of what it is that government's doing. So the main message is, please don't wait. Please get on and plan. Go to discussion groups, get your business plan in place, and then also get involved in helping us shape the future. Because the only way we're going to make this work is if we all work together across the farming community to understand what's going to work and what isn't and make the right things happen.
The main headline, which everybody's talking about and everybody's known for a long time now, is that BPS is being phased out and there'll be far more focus on environmental delivery. The big concern for a lot of farmers is that in between period, as we get towards the new system and how their own personal finances are going to be impacted. What would you say to those farmers who are concerned?
So first of all, we heard those concerns and that's why we've adjusted our plans. So we are now doing a gradual rollout, which will start in 2021. So you won't see suddenly one day moving from the old system to the new in 2024, but instead a kind of gradual rollout. So each year, the money we take from direct payments will go back into the sector, either through prosperity and productivity support or through either existing or new schemes. So if you're looking at what you can do now, we will be publishing details of the new simplified countryside stewardship scheme in the first quarter of next year. And I really encourage people to take a look at that. Don't wait for environmental land management. If you're thinking about getting involved in agri-environment schemes, then have a look at countryside stewardship next year. And we will provide a smooth path for people in countryside stewardship to move over to environmental land management when it's ready. So don't wait is my main message on that. And don't see it as a kind of gap between now and 2024. There are loads of different things you can get involved in right now. You can apply for countryside stewardship. There are various different schemes for trees and woodland. There'll be productivity support from next year. And then from 2022, the sustainable farming incentive will come in, and we'll be publishing more details about that in the first half of next year. Because we don't want there to be a gap. We want this to be a smooth and gradual transition. But then I would also say, this is not just about replacing your lost BPS income with money from environment schemes, because in order to plan and adapt, we think many farmers who are not already in the top quartile of profitability will need to look at their whole farm. And they'll need to look at their profit margin to see, is there anything I can do to reduce my costs? Is there anything I can do to increase my margin? So I would really encourage those who are not already doing it. And I know that dairy is already very, very much more commercial than some of the other sectors. But if you don't already have a business plan, now is the right time to start thinking about that and making that business plan. And if you haven't already looked at, for example, the Nethergill work on how to make your farm profitable, then now's a good time to do that, to see how you can increase your margin. And then particularly on dairy farms, I mean, dairy farms are generally more profitable and there is a smaller range of profitability within dairy than there is in other sectors. And there's a smaller amount of revenue that comes from basic payments than there is in other sectors. For dairy, it's about 5%, for example, compared with more like 14% for cereals. But there are dairy farms that already have a negative farm business income, and that could increase if you don't take any action. That will increase as you lose your basic payments. So really, it's very important for people to get on and start planning now and think about how to reduce your costs. And that's reducing your costs. I know lots, by the way, I don't mean to suggest for a second that farmers don't think about these things already. Of course, I know they do. And all the farmers I've visited have told me about what they're doing to reduce their costs. But from all the evidence we've looked at, when we compare the top quartile of farms by profitability with the bottom quartile, there are definitely some things that are more commonly done by those more profitable farms, which we'd encourage others to look at. And they include having a business plan, looking at breeding, looking at feed efficiency, really good disease and welfare control, nutrient management, manure management, and also getting a better price for your outputs by meeting more of the standards that are required. So in the case of milk, looking at fat and protein levels to see, can you get a better price for your milk? But I do want to say, I am in no way sitting here in Whitehall suggesting that I know how farmers should farm, and I wouldn't dream of telling any individual farmer how to do things on their farm. What you're going to do will depend on your own circumstances, on your ambition, etc. And I wouldn't dream of presuming to know better than a farmer what they should do.
Roz, can we bring you in here? What will the loss of BPS mean for farm income and profitability from your point of view?
Well, I agree with Janet in terms of, you know, that we're going to see variations across the sectors inevitably. And also within the sectors, it does depend where your business sits at the moment. Mm. And Janet's referred to top quartiles and bottom quartiles in terms of performance. And then that obviously, you know, impacts where people will be and, you know, how reliant they are on the BPS payments. I mean, just to put it in perspective a little bit, in 2019, the average BPS payment was about 27,000. Obviously, there is large variations across that, but as an average, if you look at a lowland beef and sheep farm, for example, their net farm income was about break even in 2019. So you can see as a sector in terms of profitability, they're much more exposed. And probably in that sector, we're going to see more, you know, more rationalisation. On the dairy side, again, as Janet said, we tend to be less reliant on BPS. It's around about 1.4 pence per litre. So we're less reliant, but it's still a fairly big chunk of income. And for, you know, average dairy farms, it can get towards, you know, a third half of their profit level. So adapting is going to be really important. We do have dairy businesses already operating without BPS. And we have dairy businesses who've also looked to the future and deliberately positioned their businesses so it's making a much less significant contribution and, you know, positioning their businesses for these changes already. But I think where it's a larger element, you know, producers will need definitely to be making plans to looking at how they're going to be able to adapt, you know, through improved productivity. And Janet's listed a number of areas that we'll be looking at with clients, you know, around improved productivity, taking advantage of techniques, new technologies, looking at cross management, looking at all areas of the business, and also looking for the new environmental schemes and where they can work within your business. You know, for some people, looking for those schemes to take a larger aspect of your business might be appropriate for them, taking more advantage of those opportunities. For other people, improving current productivity and using that to mitigate the loss might be important for them. But whatever we need to do, we need to start planning now for that phase change.
Absolutely. I mean, let's pause for a minute and think about some of those challenges on a farm level. I mean, there's quite a lot happening here in a relatively short space of time, reducing direct payments substantially at the same time as asking farmers to up their environmental delivery. What sort of challenges, Ros, do you think that this will create on farm?
Well, no doubt these are big challenges. This is probably one of the biggest changes that's happened for a large period of time. And I think the key thing for me is it's not just the BPS payment changes. There are two things happening at the same time here, which are really important to be aware of. You've got the BPS changes and the phase reduction in BPS. But also you've got the increasing need to comply with environmental requirements through the Clean Air Act and the investments that that's going to need. So if we look at a typical dairy farm over this sort of next 4 to 5 year period, you know, they could be looking at changes of sort of 1.5 to 2 pence a litre in terms of the impact on their business. So for me, the key message here is mind the gap that's going to occur as a result of these two things happening at the same time. You know, there is going to be support through the period to help with some of these investment requirements, but there's still a need to manage the gap. What I think producers need to do, they need to look at their current cash position and their profitability. They need to look at the impact that they think the BPS is going to be for them. They need to look at what they think the investment requirements are going to be with compliance and start to make those plans now. And also to look at the new schemes and see how those might fit in for their businesses. For some, they might fit in a larger way, for some in a smaller way. But, you know, there are going to be ways that they can work those into their business to help with mitigating and managing these changes.
Janet, what's your vision for a future livestock farm? What would it actually look like on the ground?
So the first thing to say about this is it depends. And I'm not in the business of telling farmers how to farm. And I've learned on my limited time in the programme so far that there is no such thing as a typical farm. So I'm not going to try and describe a typical farm. What I will say is our vision is that every farm is sustainable, viable, thriving, productive, productive for both food and the environment without having to rely on subsidies by the end of this transition. And that's our kind of, if I had a single aim in my head, that would be the aim I have and my kind of purpose in life for the next 7 years as we lead, as we go through this program. But in terms of what it would look like actually on the ground, we're not dictating a single approach for all farms to take, because we know it depends on your preferences, your soil type, your location, what your ambition is for your environmental contribution. And that's why we've got a range of different components in environmental land management, so that there's something there for everyone. I think I have seen some farms that I think are doing really interesting things where they're able to make a profit and be more productive for the environment by taking either a regenerative approach or something similar to that. And on those farms, what they tend to do is reduce their level of production and therefore reduce their costs and also reduce the pressure that they're causing on the environment and create more kind of space and opportunity for a more biodiverse environment. And so, for example, Neil Heseltine's doing that in the sheep industry. The Renesons are doing that up in Cumbria. Danny Teasdale showed me around a bunch of farms in Ullswater where they're introducing some of these approaches. And what I think is really interesting about that is combining better profitability with better environmental outcomes. But that isn't for everyone. It doesn't work in all settings. And that's why we've got a range of different approaches in place. Where those farmers do that, it does look different. The farm has longer grass. It looks a bit more messy. There's much more wildlife. Maybe there's lower stocking density on a given patch of land because they're trying to produce the optimum amount given nature's free gifts, as Martin Lines calls them. And they look quite different. And that's quite a kind of interesting thing culturally and emotionally for people to look at those farms and think, well, that represents good farming, when we're used to thinking good farming is very neat and tidy. And so I think the future is going to be quite diverse, quite interesting, quite challenging, and I think quite exciting. And that's why I've chosen to come and do this job.
Janet, where does food production and food security fit within the plan? So foresters are saying that we need to up commercial timber production. Environmentalists are saying we need to improve the state of nature generally, and that's a big part of the plan. But what about food security? Where does that fit within your vision?
So food security is really important, and that's part of the reason why we have a vibrant competitive sector as one of our two main aims. You might know that the Agriculture Act requires government now to report on food security every 3 years. And we're expecting to do that. And when we do that, though, we're expecting to cover a much wider range of policies than just the one that I'm responsible for. So I'm looking at what we do with £2.5 billion a year, which is a lot of money. But the food industry is worth many, many times that amount. And there are many, many other issues involved, including things like trade, food pricing, global markets and food availability, food safety, and all of those, that wider range of issues. And so I think you'll see when we do a report on food security, you would expect it to cover that much wider range of issues. And there's the other thing that's relevant here is Henry Dimbleby's work. He's been doing an independent review of food strategy for government, and he's expected to come out with part two of his review, so the concluding part of that review of food. And that will include, I would expect, coverage of food security as well as all of the other issues. So in my programme, we're very focused on making sure the sector is productive and competitive and also securing those environmental outcomes. But part of my job is making sure that I link in with that wider range of policies and make sure what we're doing is consistent with what's happening on trade, food pricing, food safety, etc. I would have to say, though, that I'm responsible for quite a lot of things, but I'm not responsible I'm not responsible for absolutely everything. So I'm not going to go too far into talking about that policy area, because it's not my specialist area.
No. I mean, Roz, I mean, in future, farmers are going to be doing a lot more of everything in many ways, certainly to start with, before things settle down a bit. But what's your view on the food security point?
Well, it's a critical area, I think we've looked at it in our Dairy 2030 document that we sort of published earlier in the year, and looking at, you know, how the industry could maintain its output levels but still reduce its sort of environmental impact. And we felt there was tremendous potential around the productivity areas in order to increase yields per animal and reducing numbers, and that enables us to reduce our environmental footprint. There's tremendous capability in terms of new techniques, and we're looking at things like genetics, better nitrogen balancing, better feed efficiency. working to improve, you know, the managers in the business and taking advantage of all new technologies. And I think by doing this, we felt it was possible to achieve significant productivity improvements whilst reducing our impact on the environment and maintaining that food security, which is vital for us as a country.
What's the thinking behind the lump sum exit scheme, Janet? I keep seeing this phrase, retire with dignity, around. Is this about farm businesses exiting the industry completely, or about older individuals retiring to allow younger people to move into management positions?
It's really intended for, I mean, I wouldn't say it's not, we don't have an age restriction on it, but it's for people, it's for individuals who want to leave the sector. Mm. So that others can then come and take over that business. And so we think there's a positive way through the transition for most farms and farmers, but we think there will be, we know there will be some people who are ready to retire or ready to leave the sector, and we want to enable them to do that. So the lump sum exit scheme, for anyone who hasn't yet read the full document cover to cover, I'm sure there can't be anybody that applies to, but just in case, the lump sum exit scheme is where we are going to consult early next year about the details of this, but the plan is that we'll offer in 2022 a scheme where you can cash out your remaining BPS entitlements for the remainder of the transition period, so that you can take them in one lump sum. And the condition of doing that is that you leave the sector, so that it's a kind of exit package for anybody who might want to do that. And the reason we say it with dignity is because we don't want anybody to be left without a choice in this situation. We think there are positive choices for most businesses to go through, but we think there are some individuals who will not want to do that, or not be able to see a way through, and we want to provide them with a way to find a different path for the future for them.
Mm. Okay. Roz, as Janet was saying, there's still a fair amount of consultation to come. There's still a fair amount of detail to come. But let's see where we are right now. What are the opportunities here for dairy farmers? And other opportunities for growth or for new entrants, for example? Or will this just be a period of lie low and try to survive while things settle down?
Well, I never really think that lying low and trying to hide is a particularly good way of approaching things. I do think that any period of change, you know, offers opportunity more really than a period of stability. And there is undoubtedly a lot coming down the road at farmers, a lot of things they're going to need to manage and look at. But, you know, that does create opportunities. And things that people can grasp that might not have been there in periods of stability. You know, Janet's mentioned the new entrance schemes and the exit schemes. Both of those will help offer transition, hopefully smoother transition in and out of the industry. You could have short-term impacts on sort of milk supply that could have impacts, and you could even through the change period maybe see some impact on asset values. All of that gives opportunities for people. I think it's all about mindset, really, isn't it? You know, taking control of where you want to take your business and being ready to jump and grasp those opportunities as they occur. I mean, if you look at the pig and poultry sector, you know, an unsupported sector who had to go through tremendous change, you know, in the early 2000s, dealing with changes in legislation around housing and animal welfare. You know, and they've grasped that. Inevitably, some of the people have moved out of the industry, but the ones that are in the industry have grasped that with a really positive attitude. And now, if you look at a lot of the businesses in the pig and poultry sector, you know, they're doing really, really well. So I come back to it's about mindset. It's about looking for those opportunities. And personally, I think through periods of change, there's likely to be more opportunities for people to take a hold of and move forward with positively.
Definitely. Well, great way to end on a bit of positivity. That's all we have time for, but a big thank you to our guests today, Janet Hughes, Roz Hughes and Chris Walkland.
Yes, thank you very much for listening. Also, next week will be the final episode of the podcast this year, and what a year it has been. Until then, though, have a great weekend, and it's goodbye from all of us here.